And we're back. It is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm very pleased to have as guests Ilya Samari and David Habtsi. Did I say that right?
Dawit Habtsi.
Dawit, yes. I looked and I wonder how often your name gets turned into David on you. Dawit, and I apologize for that. By the way, Dawit is the author of Gratitude in Low Voices, a memoir, and we'll be talking about that book as we go along. Ilya Samari, you've been our guest before. You were here with Sophia.
Sophia Tsvamariam, yes. 5 years ago, we had the pleasure of visiting your studio. And yes. A great conversation. Time flies by.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you back because, well, for one thing, we were talking about your country, Eritrea, which has an enormous neighbor, a big neighbor, what, 100 million people?
Ethiopia, yes.
Ethiopia has 100 million. And it has an attitude towards Eritrea, rather like a demanding uncle or something. And
a former colonizer and one whose regime still maintains grand ambitions of expansion.
Uncomfortable with the idea that you're independent.
Uncomfortably.
And then on top of that, they themselves have a big friend now who has been more and more speaking about Eritrea. So it's been 5 years now. Eritrea has come through this rather well. I'm hearing good things about developments inside the country in terms of the economy and its education and whatnot. So you explain to me how do you face up to two powers like that and manage? How does Eritrea do that?
Well, that's Eritrea's tradition of tenacity in self-reliance struggle. As you know, Eritrea struggled against overwhelming odds to achieve its independence in 1991. Against overwhelming odds, geopolitical interests, the United States in 1940s pushed for Eritrea to be annexed by its then ally, Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. Mm. And then in the 1970s, there was a coup d'etat against the Emperor Haile Selassie and the regime of the Derg, the military junta, aligned itself with the Soviet Union, declared itself socialist. And so there was a reversal on the Soviet side. Yeah. So 30 years of long, bitter struggle, but the Eritreans finally achieved their independence in
1991.
And from 1991, the past 26 years has not been an easy, smooth road.
No, you had a war there.
A war in 1998, 2000, ostensibly for border dispute, a border war that was really never about borders, but grand ambitions of re-annexing Eritrea. And the United States at that time played a role of facilitating a peace process, but they were really on the side of Ethiopia. Their client stayed there.
It's like a soccer game where the referee is against you.
Yeah, and the goalposts keep moving constantly. Mm-hmm. So the peace treaty was signed in Algiers in December 2000 with the guarantor as the United States, the European Union, the African Union. And according to that peace treaty, in accordance with it, a border commission was set to resolve the dispute. And the border commission was set at The Hague Arbitration Court, International Arbitration Court. And per, the treaty, the decision of the border commission was to be final and binding. So the two countries presented their arguments, colonial treaty maps, and what have you. And finally, the ruling was rendered on April 13, 2002, 15 years ago. Eritrea, of course, immediately accepted. And the casus belli, Badime, was assigned that it was sovereign Eritrean territory. Ethiopia to this day refused to accept the...
By the way, am I right? Do they have forces there that are in Eritrean territory?
Yes, occupying Badme and other sovereign Eritrean territories to this date.
Yes.
Refusing to abide by international law, the international community, largely the U.S., has so far... ignored the responsibility to enforce this ruling of the court, and Ethiopia continues to occupy large chunks of Eritrean territory.
You know, I noticed, and we're speaking to Elias Amare, and by the way, I'm just learning the magic of Twitter, because Elias has a very nice Twitter account, which
and Facebook
contemporaneous, and it would really help. You posted most recently a very nice video explaining the sanctions issue and such.
Yes, interview with Eric Dreiser.
Oh, and your interview with Eric Dreiser. But there was a good film.
Yes,
available,
a short
showing
documentary.
The UN discussion.
Yes,
and. What I was struck by was that Eritrea, despite – there's always, of course, the word – people use the word isolation or, mysterious or
the North
whatever.
Korea of Africa.
But, you fare very well in international forums when you actually are debating and voting. The vote on the issue of sanctions, which I don't understand why they're there in the first place, but the U.S. was the one that seemed isolated. They didn't come out of that very well. I was so impressed with the Chinese, the Egyptians,
the Angolans,
the Venezuelans.
Venezuela was strong.
Very impressive, and their argumentation.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the sanctions part, because we'd like to see the sanctions lifted. What is the status of that debate, and why are they still in place?
The sanctions primarily were imposed, engineered by the United States with the alliance of Ethiopia, of course, to deflect attention away from the border issue or the occupation of Eritrean territory by Ethiopia.
The accusation is that Eritrea is involved in Somalia.
Supporting, yes, the Al-Shabaab terrorist group in Somalia and a fabricated border conflict with Djibouti. That there was never any dispute on the borders, but Djibouti was instigated to claim some Eritrean territories, but Qatar mediated that dispute, and that dispute is supposed to be resolved. So the two main reasons for the sanctions, the support for Al-Shabaab by Eritrea has been proven to be totally baseless and false. Mm-hmm. For the past consecutive 4 years, the Somalia-Eritrea Monitoring Group of the Sanctions Committee has said that Eritrea does not support Al-Shabaab. Yeah. So the sanctions should have been lifted. These sanctions hurt the people. But because the United States, which engineered the sanctions to be imposed in the first place in 2009, refuses to budge on that issue, even though the 14 other members of Security
Council. And they have, of course, that special status as the Security Council, a kind of, without using, they're invoking that word veto, there is that kind of U.S. power that just even they can hold out against everyone in terms of this, whether or not sanctions would remain.
Yes, yes, indeed.
But the climate, I'm interested in knowing too, and I'm so glad you guys have come, because it strikes me that something new is going on with the now in the Security Council. Their differences are getting sharper and sharper.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia, who for a period of 15, 20 years was very compliant and actually not interested. Mm-hmm. They just simply looked out the window while the U.S. did what. Now they're starting to make noise.
Assert themselves.
And I wonder how that is impacting. And China, too, seems a little uncomfortable with – I shouldn't say a little. They're starting to get very uncomfortable. So is this impacting the situation? Do you consider that a positive development, or how do you look at that?
It is indeed a positive development in light of the larger global hegemon's stand on this issue. These countries like China and Russia, Venezuela, Egypt, Angola and others are beginning to question the validity of this. If there is no reason to maintain the sanctions, basically the support of Al-Shabaab is baseless, proven to be baseless. The Djibouti conflict is no longer there. Why then maintain these sanctions is what they're asking increasingly. Mm-hmm. So it's part of the great effort by Eritrea to break the isolation and reach out to the international community and present its case, its arguments, which are gaining momentum and support. And hopefully this this coming November, that sanctions will be
lifted. Well, there's some important dates coming up very, very soon, aren't there? At the UN about this, I forget the name of the, what the issue is. At May 17, there is some kind of monitoring group. The UN monitoring group is going to report. Is that apropos of the sanctions or just a general assessment of the situation? You have some, is that some
general assessment of situation? They presented their report in the past month, April, to the sanctions committee. So the monitoring group is mandated to report its findings for the whole year, and the mandate is up to November, the coming November.
So that would, I assume that this will all be like, well, they'll go through this all again. But some things that come up in relation to UN also want to make sure I ask about, and that is these words human rights get invoked a lot, and I'm always embarrassed that the United States has the gall to talk about human rights because, you know, they have partners who are absolute monarchs to whom they give every kind of weapon, like, you know, they stop at nothing. But meanwhile, they want to scrutinize Eritrea. And one of the people who wrote I noticed the Eritrea spoke out about was the individual in charge of the United Nations Human Rights at the Moment Committee is he's a Jordanian prince. Jordan actually isn't considered terribly exemplary that I know of. And yet he can make a report very harmful to your country.
Yes. And again, the human rights issue is used as a stick with which to bludgeon non-subservient countries like Eritrea, who refuse to comply with the diktats of, you know, the global hegemon and their agenda. So from experience, we have seen how they use human rights to eventually build up towards humanitarian intervention and what they call the R2P, responsibility to protect, and then intervene militarily and bring about regime change. Yes. So, you know, frightening experience recently, what happened to Libya, what is happening in Syria is a good example of that.
Yeah, I wonder, I may as well get your comments. And by the way, I do intend to bring Dawit Habte into this. Our listeners are probably saying, well, what about Dawit? And we'll ask, you know, just a moment about it. But I get the impression that this R2P thing is losing its venom. Say 5 years ago, it was a magic formula. Someone complained about, they said, oh, I don't like my country. I don't like the, so-and-so's a dictator. Then someone write a human rights report, and then they'd call up NATO, and then NATO would come.
Bombards and destroys.
And destroy nations. Everything and to call it democracy or whatever. Or better than it was. I think that's become the new way of putting it. Well, everybody's dead, but it's better than it was.
Yes, yes. You are right in pointing out that this R2P and humanitarian intervention are losing their venom. They're no longer fashionable, so they're toning down on that. But still, that is in the background. So the accusation against Eritrea on human rights violation, actually, if you look at the region, the Horn of Africa, the greatest violator of human rights with credible reports of crimes committed at the genocidal proportion is Ethiopia, the client state. But nobody invokes that against Ethiopia. In fact, it is covered and hidden.
Well, and look at the politics. I can recall there was an absolute crusade here in Canada and the United States that they were going to go and arrest the leader of Sudan. And the whole world should come to a full stop until they had got him for his crimes in Darfur. He has now been taken off the list. It's just like, no, scratch that. And you say, well, what has changed? And, of course, what has changed is they have a new relationship with him.
Yes.
So it's not a – for someone who actually believes, by the way, in human rights, they'd have to be dismayed.
It's a sad situation.
It's a rather hypocritical exercise.
Where human rights, the laudable values, universal human rights, are being trampled for political purposes. And as you said, for people who genuinely believe in human rights, it's disheartening that this honorable universal values of human rights are being used for geopolitical purposes.
Yes.
What happened in Libya is a perfect example. In Sudan, we saw acrobatics where, if you toe the line and comply with the global hegemon, the United States, then you would be scratched off the list of human rights, no questions asked.
Yes.
But if you, like Eritrea, if you maintain an independent political path, an independent economic path, and genuinely develop your people's capacity for social justice, social progress, then you're targeted and punished. And this is what had been happening to Eritrea. But despite that, though, I must say that the picture is not gloom and doom.
It doesn't actually. No, I have to say, despite the fact that you have the opponents that you have, you are well in boxing. They'd say you're fighting above your weight.
Indeed,
and not only that, you're beginning to gain ground because this slight, maybe not so slight, the change of shifting of the powers, it allows, among other things, more light to be shown. I think your voice is being heard despite the fact all this attempt to sanction and isolate Eritrea.
It has, yes. Finally, it is proving to be futile. The relentless war by media, as John Pilger called it, the great investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker John Pilger had recently an excellent article on propaganda and the triumph of war by media. So that's exactly what had been happening to Eritrea. The West's mainstream corporate media has been harping, demonizing Eritrea constantly. But finally, truth is emerging. And, Eritrea's achievement.
It's a stubborn thing, as they say.
It is. Truth is stubborn, yes. Yeah. Finally, it is coming out. And people of goodwill, progressives, are realizing that Eritrea, despite all these hostilities, is making tremendous achievement in terms of the Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations, one of the few countries in Africa that had achieved the targets of the Millennium Development Goals in terms of education, reduction of infant mortality, provision of healthcare, women's equality and participation, environmental protection, international cooperation, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. By the way, I really recommend, please go to Elias Amari's Twitter account, and all these things that he's telling you, you can see the pictures, which we're a picture culture now, and it is very, very impressive.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break because we also want to speak to Dawit Habte. But before we do, we're going to listen to we're going to be listening to some music. So can you tell us, what is this music we're hearing from Eritrea?
This song in Tigrinya was from the days of the national liberation struggle. And it's by a singer called Tesfaye Mahari. Fehera is his nickname. And it's titled Awet Kalsena, the victory of our struggle through our blood and toil is eventually, truth is going to triumph over injustice, and we will win alongside of our oppressed people.
Good, good. Well, listen up and sing along, and you will have an Eritrean song to keep your spirits up.
Thank you. خوش شام لخنم الله تاریخ تفرس و میگنم گنم 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 قوشت مسخم شام لحنان الله تاریخ که بود تمی گنام 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 اوش نمسح نا
The sound of your city. CIUT 89.5, Toronto. Listen to us on the go with TuneIn Radio's free app or go to the live stream at www.ciut.fm. Right here, right now, every day. CIUT 89.5 FM.
And we're back. It is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're talking about Eritrea, the Horn of Africa, the superpowers, etc. We're speaking to Ilya Samari, and of course we're joined now by Dawit Habte. And he has written a great book called Gratitude in Low Voices, and it's a memoir. And Ilya, I know that you've been... For one thing, you told me about this book and how important it is. By way of introduction, tell us about this man's book, and then we'll ask Dawit.
Dawit's story, Gratitude in Low Voices, is indeed an impressive, remarkable, universal story that begins with his personal narrative, his life journey. As a young man, he was forced to flee his country in the 1980s to avoid conscription by Ethiopia. And he arrives in the United States as a teenager. And that's when I first met him in the early 90s, 92, 93. And he impressed me as a serious-minded, hard-working, studious person. And I said to myself, then I keep reminding him, that someday he's gonna make a tremendous achievement, and indeed I was vindicated. So he weaves his personal narrative and examines then why was I forced to flee my country, mm-hmm. And he brings examines the geopolitical background and the historical context of the Eritrean struggle. And so it is a mix of the personal narrative along with the grand story of the nation, geopolitics, superpowers, well written.
Well, he's with us now. It's Dawit Habte. And welcome, and thank you for being so patient in all this discussion. And by the way, what's your take on some of this? Does the narrative we've been engaging in here, does that describe the Eritrea, you know, and the experience with Ethiopia?
Actually, first of all, thank you very much for mm-hmm. having me and having my good friend and elder brother Elias with us. It does. In fact, what Gratitude in Low Voices does, in addition to my personal narrative, is it gives historical perspective mm-hmm. to the geopolitical chess game that was played specifically in the eastern part of Africa. And mm-hmm. Eritrea was basically used as a chess piece in this global political, mm-hmm. I don't think there's any better term than hegemony mm-hmm. For Africa and basically for the rest of the continent, specifically though, the eastern part of Africa. Gratitude in Low Voices, as Elias alluded, is a human story. Mm. It is basically, it gives a context to the human interactions and mm-hmm. the positive that comes out of it.
Yeah. Is your story that you they wanted to place you in the Ethiopian army? They wanted to – did. How does that happen? I mean, was that part of the
– Yes. And it's not only my story. Mm-hmm. Mine is just a micro story of the Eritrean youth at the time and before. In addition to my conscription to the Ethiopian army to fight against my uncles, my brothers, my aunts, the Asmara had become this hostage city that where house to house search on a daily basis had become a norm. That had become part of our daily life.
Mm-hmm.
One example I give in the book is where my grandfather got up at 5 a.m. and he was on his way to church and he was stopped by the Ethiopian military and he was sent back and he has to alert my mom, and my mom woke up the entire family to make sure there is nothing that is related to either Eritrea or the Eritrean armed struggle that within the house.
Mm.
And the whole day we were basically we were stuck in the house and we were waiting when our turn would come. And late in the afternoon, our turn came and our house basically was searched by even picking up a cup and putting it upside down.
Mm-hmm.
So it was one of the most terrifying experience. But at the same time, that was the normal life.
Uh-huh.
Our life had become a continuous basically we were expecting, we were not even sure if there would be another search the next day or the day after.
Mm-hmm.
And
but at that time, did you have any, it'd be hard to have hope. How did you feel? Did you think, well, this is going to end? What sort of resources do you draw on when you're in it? Did you understand Eritrean history in terms of resistance to this kind of thing?
I did have some basic understanding because I grew up listening when I became 13, 14, 12, 13, 14. I started listening to the voice of the masses that was broadcasted by the Eritrean People's Liberation Front.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question regarding hope, my parents at that time gave up hope. And it was for them the only option they had was to send our kids, their kids outside of the country.
Yeah.
And with respect to hope, one thing I stress in Gratitude in Low Voices is the fact that refugees live only on hope.
Mm-hmm.
They eat, they drink, and they sleep on hope. That's the only thing that they have. And the hope of reaching their destination.
And you were talking about a struggle the last 30 years, right?
Yes.
So, you know, I think it is a great tribute. I mean, by the way, I hope everybody gets this book, Gratitude in Low Voices, a memoir, Dawit Habti. Because, we talk about this as though that happened. But how many of us could go through a 30-year struggle, because you lose leaders, right? I mean, and outstanding people, intellectuals are lost in prison. And continually you're dealing with an opponent, very large opponent.
Yes, and I try to give even a larger context in Gratitude in Low Voices when it comes to Eritrea being used as a chess piece in this global politics, in the fact that Eritrea's fate was actually decided in 1945 by President Roosevelt when he actually presented as a gift Eritrea to Haile Selassie.
Uh-huh.
The rest, in terms of the 10 years of British administration, the Federation, they were just steps to eventual elimination of Eritrea as a country.
Mm-hmm.
So that decision that was made in 1945 through Roosevelt's administration, and there was also an interest in oil in Ethiopia, where a company called Sinclair Oil Company,
Very famous company. Now that I think of it,
Yes, yeah? And they made the argument that for them to capitalize on the newfound oil in Ethiopia, Eritrea must be handed to Ethiopia. So all this
something
so
for
pipelines
something.
Could be built to send it to the port of Eritrea, the port of Asab.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. Yeah. So this we have to look at issues, especially when it comes to Eritrea and other disadvantaged countries, from a context where there is this aspect of the superpowers that they overlook the human cost in terms of when they...
Well, I guess, they notice it, but it's not a major figure in their calculations.
Yeah. There is a poignant quote, Phil, in the book Dawit highlights. It's written by a British historian, Africanist, David Poole by name, from his book Eritrea, Africa's Longest War. And it reads... Without giving any consideration to the wishes and aspirations of the Eritreans, quote, Eritrea was federated with Ethiopia in 1952, not because of the proofs of history, but because the Ethiopian version fitted the interests of the foreign powers which decided the future of Eritrea after the defeat of Italy, the former colonizer of Eritrea, in the Second World War. So basically Eritrea was... made the sacrificial lamb to advance the geopolitical interests of the United States at that time, and made to be annexed with Ethiopia.
Yeah. It shows certainly our problem is not the Eritrean people, the Ethiopian people. It's a notion of empire. I have a problem with people who say, for example, Americans love to say they love their country. They seem to love other people's countries. I always find it odd that they don't notice that the other guy has a right to love his country. And if you understood that, you would, of course, love your own, but not have designs on your neighbor. You should, if they're proud of their own country. So what they don't actually love their country. They love empire. And that's a sickness. To want to rule over another people without their permission or any negotiation. It's just simply it would be better for you to to do this.
This is sadly what the late
we have an empire problem.
What the late Professor Chalmers Johnson calls the sorrow of empires in his trilogy, the Blowback Trilogy.
I'm glad you raised his name, Chalmers Johnson. That was two or three volumes. Didn't he devote to this?
Yes, the three volumes.
I'm not surprised
sorrows of empire.
I'm not surprised Ilya Samari would know about him since you had
books.
The boot on your foot. And Dawit Habte. Also, I want to ask both of you this about empires in the neighborhood. Just I'm sorry, I know it fits into your experience. The empires are back in a way, but as we mentioned earlier in the show, they're somewhat contentious. Something strange is going on. China now has something in Djibouti. I don't know what it is, but it seems to relate to military matters. And the United States has something in Djibouti. And, of course, France always did. France has never agreed to go away from their favorite port. But is that a worrisome development that these two great powers are sitting alongside each other?
Yes, it is worrisome. Increasingly, what we are witnessing in Africa is the new scramble for Africa, like the old colonial European scramble for Africa in the late 19th century. It seems we are witnessing... History is repeating itself, sadly. And these great powers are vying for territorial control, increasing militarization and intervention, garrisoning of the continent.
And if they quarrel, they will come through as thinking you belong to them, right? Or trying to re-colonize.
Very worrisome development and very close home to Eritrea. Eritrea, as you know, is located strategically on the Red Sea. One of the busiest maritime lanes of the world, where 40% of world
By the way, you and Djibouti share something that the Ethiopians envy, which is ports, right?
Yes, geography has been the curse of Eritrea. But, I mean, it wouldn't have been a problem for Ethiopia to use Eritrea's ports, Djibouti, under friendly.
It could be negotiated.
Negotiated, right. And. Yeah.
But not master slave.
I was, no.
Yes.
Dawit, you were going to say.
Yes,
sorry.
I was going to give a different perspective, actually. And
okay,
I was going
good.
To go to Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yes, where he actually separates the system of governance and the people,
mm-hmm.
where his hope is in the American people, in their institutions, in their communities, in their PTAs, in their civic organizations. Those mm-hmm. are the hope of the mm-hmm. country. And in Gratitude in Low Voices, I do stress and I do make significant, I do provide significant information from personal experience how different at times the people and the institutions are from the system of governance.
Yes.
That's why the title, Gratitude in Low Voices.
Yes. And because those institutions you're talking about are not imperial.
They are not. They're,
this
they're
is
not.
Self-governance.
They are not. Absolutely. They're
the concept of governance and respect for the citizen is there. It's a very impressive.
Even Tocqueville, he states that he does not understand how a democratic society reconciles itself with slavery.
Yes.
So I understand what you're saying. Yes. I do understand exactly what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
But we still have to go back to the basics.
Mm-hmm.
The people are decent. They are. The Americans are some of the most philanthropic societies.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where the institutions come to play. And those are the institutions that will have an impact on the governing bodies.
Yeah. By the way, this is the voice of Dawit Habte, author of Gratitude in Low Voices, a memoir. And please get a copy of that. This idea, and maybe we're seeing it a bit. We're hearing that the society is dividing American society itself. And, of course, I think you live there, both of you spend a lot of time there. And you sort of have to look in the window and listen to them argue, but there is a healthy element there saying we don't want to be a world policeman.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We don't want to invade. We're tired of wars. Mm-hmm. There is definitely that. And that voice has always been there. It's simply not ignored by the people who want an empire. But the people who want an empire seem to be a smaller and smaller group. I guess they're called the 1%, right?
Yeah.
If you were to really give the American people a chance to talk about that, they would certainly the polls show they don't really like war, and they're not they don't understand all these foreign operations.
But even within the 1%, you have people like Mike Bloomberg, who actually are more focused on making the world better, a better place.
Mm-hmm.
One of the individuals who actually supported Gratitude in Low Voices. Significantly,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure.
Oh, Bloomberg! Yes, I'm
Bloomberg,
sorry.
Yes.
That's,
and you are aware of his pledge for $1 billion for a cure of cancer within mm-hmm. 10 years. So mm-hmm. you have people who are even fighting within the 1%.
Well, Bloomberg took an interest in you and this book, right? He
yes.
wanted you to write it, or
he supported me.
Yeah.
Significantly, not only with this book, but mm-hmm. with an idea or proposal that I presented to Mike Bloomberg back in 1999, mm-hmm. where he funded my initiative to go to Eritrea to start up an IT training and mm-hmm. software development firm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to go to my good friend Elias's question, where the title Gratitude in Low Voices came from, the title actually was picked by the primary editor of Gratitude in Low Voices, Peter Clark of Rosetta Books. And he picked it from a section of the book where I came home with an award of a prize. I was first from my class. And when I told my mom that I came with a prize, she started giving her gratitude to God, to the disciples, and to all the angels.
Mm.
In that process, while she was hugging me, tears were welling in her eyes,
mm-hmm.
and she was still continuously giving gratitude to God and his disciples, but I could not hear those words. So those expressions of love and compassion, those that are not heard, are the most powerful, basic expressions of love and compassion anyone, especially a mother, could give to her offspring.
Yeah, that's a very poignant story. By the way, speakers have learned that if you speak quietly, people listen.
Yes, indeed.
If you speak loudly, they run for their lives, or they should. But yes, low voice is often sincerity.
Yes.
By the way, I worked for some time in Tanzania. I was always very impressed that the Tanzanians are a soft voice people. I've traveled around East Africa. Not everybody in East Africa has a soft voice, but you find it very common in Tanzania.
Tanzanians are remarkably soft-spoken, humble.
And when you hear that voice, you know we can solve any problem.
Indeed.
There's no alarm. Everything is going to be, well, we're going to talk about this.
Well, yes. And again, to go back again to the American institutions, with everything that is being said and done, American churches are still sponsoring both Christians, Muslims, and people without any religion.
Yeah.
So, and the churches are the soft-spoken institutions that we have to put our hope and faith on.
Yeah, you have to believe that they will come to the centers of the vast population. This is the Taylor Report. We have only a few minutes left in the CIUT and 9.5 FM, and it's Ilia Amare and Dawit Habti. I'll do something esoteric. You had Eritrea got the attention of the world, a cycling champion. Please tell me. I can tell you guys are very excited about this. It's a very important event.
Yes, we are a passionately pro-cycling nation. Maybe it comes from being former colony of Italy, but it is part of our tradition.
You got the Italians' attention.
Yes.
Wasn't he in Rome when he won?
Yes. And
Daniel Tecla-Haymanot, won the King of the Mountains prize at the Giro d'Italia recently.
Yeah.
That was a great victory, which we are very proud. Also, he had won a couple of years ago, I think, in Tour de France.
Yeah. You know, if you can produce an athletic champion, there's something going right about your culture, for sure. You know, it's hard to produce a champion. And champions don't just walk down the street and become champions. You have to have a cycling culture. Somebody has to sustain it. You have to have coaching, training. It's a proud moment, I would think.
Well, in Eritrea, sport is seen as a sign of love and basically as a celebration. And sports is well celebrated in Eritrea. And it's not only cycling. We also have the marathon, the youngest marathon winner in China, an amazing Eritrean young man. He was
Girmay Gebreselassie,
at the age of 17, I believe.
19.
And by the way, regarding the Tour de France, Daniel was the first black African to win the Tour of France. King of Mountain, yes.
Well, I hope our listeners will pay very close attention and start watching the Tour de France and pull for the Eritrean champion. I'd love to say I won a championship in Rome. It's so great. Our guests have been Ilia Amare and Dawit Habti. Mr. Habti's book is Gratitude in Low Voices, a memoir. I urge you to get that. Oh, and definitely go to the Twitter account, Ilia Amare, and do it every day, and you'll be able to keep up. You'll be very informed about Eritrean events. You won't have to rely on the Globe and Mail, which won't tell you a thing. This is the Taylor Report, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for having us, Phil.
Thank you.